This week, what a parsha. I have to say, as a rabbi, sometimes your job is to like make the parsha relevant, and sometimes it is, because we do kashrut this week, and given everything that's going on with Dohini right now, it felt particularly relevant. But that's not what we're talking about this morning, because I prepared this before all that happened. We're doing Nadav and Avihu this morning. Does anyone, before we look at this, does that strike a chord with anyone? Nadav and Avihu, who are they?
The sons of Aaron who died after they did something.
That is perfect, actually. The sons of Aaron who died after they did something. That's what they did, why they did it, and what was the reaction is what we'll spend some time doing this morning. The source pack is a little heftier than some other weeks this week. We're going to probably get through less of it. Also, then we might other weeks, it's inversely related, but I wanted to give you a lot. This is a hotly contested topic, particularly because it's so vague and ambiguous. But we'll begin with the text itself. I brought on the first two pages, the text, it's really, I even brought a little more than we needed. For the first three aliyot, I brought two translations. One is the old JPS translation from about 1918, I think. And the other is the new JPS translation, which is from the late 60s. And we'll look and see what happens to Nadav and Avihu. We'll spend some time debating just from the text, and then we'll see what the rabbis do with it. Any questions so far? Good. Starting out all right. Would anyone like to read? English is fine. Either one of you. Go ahead. So do you want to read read the other translation also, of the same verse?
Aaron's son Nadab and Abihu each took his fire pan, put fire in it, and laid incense on it. And they offered before the Lord alien fire, which he had not enjoined upon them.
Okay, so anything jump out at you? Any thoughts so far? Verse 1? Well, that makes sense. In our Chumash that we use and that most concerned at this point are using this translation.
I couldn't interpret why the word strange or alien was put in there. I didn't know what that means.
What you mean, why they changed from strange to alien?
Why they describe fire as strange or alien.
Why the Bible does.
Yes.
Right.
And
okay, so two things. Well, one, we extrapolate outwards, and in fact, this does seem to be the case somewhat, that the holier the thing, the more wonderful, but also the more dangerous, that at least biblically there is a thing. If we have time, we'll read the story of Uzzah, who's the one who helped carry the ark to Jerusalem and died in the process. But there is something about being close to God. Moses and his showing the God's face last week, during Pesach we read it, that Moses has to be hid in a cleft of a rock and can't see all of God because even Moses somehow will be in physical danger. 100% there is some general rule, and that you want to do nothing more and nothing less than what God says is when you get close to the super holy stuff. Okay. And yes, Zara is going to be key. Figuring out what Esh Zara, that's what the Hebrew word is definitely key in figuring all this out. Yes, go ahead.
Well, what strikes me is, at this point at least, we have no idea why they did this. Or at least, I don't have any idea why they did this. What's their motivation?
Excellent. So why are they doing that is a huge question. We'll spend a long time on that this morning with different answers of why that is. The short answer is it's everything from they really were moved by love of God and wanted to give their own offering, all the way down to they were trying to usurp Moses and Aaron, and everything in between. So we'll spend a lot of time on that. Anything else?
I have a question, maybe you answer later. Why God is so specific about the offerings that he gets? For example, with Cain.
Yeah. So that's a great example, because I actually read this. I had a great teacher who taught me to read the story the opposite. But that's an 2 minutes on Cain and Abel is a real interesting question of who gets really chosen there. Because who is the one God talks to? God talks to Cain, not Abel. Cain is the one who gets a message from God of what to do. God tells Cain, you might feel jealousy, but you have to rein in your emotions. Cain is the one who then even gets the challenge from God. So whether or not Abel or Cain is chosen is really up for debate, I think, which is not exactly what you were asking about. But that, like, I love the Cain and Abel story for that reason. It's a great question. One drash that I heard, we talked about a little bit in this class from the side, but that I've been processing, is the point of the strict rules of sacrifice is that one of the reasons of the sacrifice is to take the word that the drash used was homicidal nature, that we all have real violence inside of us. It's a natural part of the world. But to give us catharsis, give us a chance to do it, but in very strict, like very clear rules and guidelines in a context that makes it about God and makes it holy, as a way of saying you're not bad for being violent. Everything violent, everything can be turned towards God, but it means just like Cain had to control his impulses, so too your job is to learn how to control, and ritual is one way that you can, one tool you can use to control your impulses.
Yeah. So offered sacrifice rather than fruit and vegetable, he didn't need to kill a.
Maybe. I actually didn't even think about that, but that is a whole other level when you add it all up and put it in a line. That's very interesting. So maybe that would have been his chance. Well, I like that a lot. All right. So you might find that for the sermon at some point. Okay. Yes.
But God gave us our reptilian instinct. Be mean and kill him.
Yeah.
And then he said to himself, I made a mistake. I've got to give them.
Right. So these are eternal questions, and I think that the best answer lies in God's challenge or punishment to Adam at the end of the Garden of Eden, which is God says, your life now was going to be tough, hard and toil. And the same thing with Cain. What's your job? Your job is to curb your impulses. So God, I think at the very least, it's conceivable to read the entire world as a test for human beings, as a chance to either some sort of punishment for some sort of earlier sin, or if you want to view it positively, as an opportunity, like a chance to grow. The reason why, like, challenge and competition and all of ambition, these kinds of things all have a good side, which is to help us grow to the next step. And if we don't have the impulse, if we don't have anything to conquer, then we don't grow in that way, is at least one way to look at it. I'm not going to solve for you why human beings are created in a way that is contrary to where we want to be in 3 minutes, but that is at least one way of understanding it.
For 4 minutes,
so? Maybe. Maybe. But we've made it through one verse so far. Let's go for another and see how it goes. Would someone else like to read this time? Keep going, please.
And there came forth fire from before the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord.
And the other translation?
And fire came forth from the Lord and consumed them, thus they died at the instance of the Lord.
They are the people.
Okay,
say.
They is the people. Emma, what did you say?
I was reading the explanation is not clear for me. Why?
It's not clear for anyone. Well, so first of all, I spend a lot of time from the pulpit making God kind to people, but there is no reason that we have to read the Bible that God is kind to people. God is not kind to people on a regular basis in the Bible. But that being said, we of course want to understand God differently and want to do things like that. So yes, this is a challenging moment for how at least we as moderns want to see God. For others, this might be a really empowering moment. look how great and powerful our God is. Even these Nadav and Avihu, the priests, if they don't do exactly what's right, God's going to smite them. You know, God's really going to be on our side when we go against those, you know, wicked people that we want to conquer. Just, I mean, to put a different way of understanding that on the table. Yeah. Someone else? No? Yes. Please. They pushed the wrong button. Yeah.
Push the wrong button, that generator might explode and thereby you would die. And in many instances, quite insistent on that, that this was a particular device. It wasn't God himself, it was a device.
Interesting. Well, which ultimately is, if you play with fire, you might get burned, is like the like.
So it's poetic for us, so we think, oh.
It's a good point. Right. Sure. No, it's a good point. That's a good. I mean, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I hadn't considered. Excellent. Let's push forward and do another verse. Who's up? Who wants to read number 3? Great.
Then Moses said unto Aaron, this is it that the Lord spoke, saying, through them that are nigh unto me, I will be sanctified, and before all the people I will be glorified. And Aaron held his peace. Second definition?
Yeah.
Then Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord meant when he said, to those near to me, I show myself holy and gain glory before all the people. And Aaron was silent.
Okay. Any thoughts or anything that jumps out at you here? Yes. Okay, yeah.
I'm going to equate it to confronting someone who's holding a smoking gun and just shot and killed my son, and I'm supposed to say nothing.
Yes. So the one of our big questions is going to be, Aaron was silent. What exactly? Or Aaron held his peace. However you translate it. What exactly that means is very problematic. Yes. Oh, sorry. Wait. I called on you first. Oh, the same idea.
It's a profound silence.
Yeah.
There's so much in that sentence.
Yes.
Well, I think being overwhelmed could make a person.
So it doesn't have to be a negative silence. That's true.
Right.
Yes.
That's exactly what I wanted to say. He's probably shocked.
So that is certainly one. Yes.
I would think there's another. Remaining silent. It's hard to interpret. It's just silent. My opinion. But holding his peace is not silent. As he said, his call
yes.
He is angry. He is puzzled. He is not denying. He is clenching his teeth so he doesn't utter anything proper or inappropriate, but he ain't liking.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't know the word yidom that well. By yidom.
It means just stay still like a piece of salt.
So Aaron was still. Yeah, Lot's wife. Okay, at another place, and now I'm blanking on where, which is what I expected to see here, the rest of the camp, all of the rest of Israel mourns Nadav and Avihu. Maybe I didn't include it in this one. And Aaron stays quiet. Ah, yeah, here it is, verse 6 at the end. But let your brethren, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning which the Lord hath kindled. So the end of it there. So just, I don't want to spend any more time, so much time on the text, but basically Aaron's cousins, go and get the bodies and take care of them. There is a mourning period during which Aaron is quiet. Then, and the rest of everyone else mourns. And then we get the, God tells Aaron, okay, there's some of the rules of priests. You can't drink wine. You can't be right when you're going to go do the sacrifice. You can have wine like the night before. It's like a DWI kind of a thing. No sacrificing while intoxicated. and that's the big one. So, I mean, that's where you may have heard the most common interpretation is that Nadav and Abihu were drunk, and that's the problem, and that's where it comes from, right? Afterwards, we get the rule not to drink. Yes.
The word yadom, is that related to root yadam?
I don't think so. I think the yud usually means that it's got like a hey or a yud first letter, but I'm not sure. Or I don't know if you would, if you know any better. I don't know what the root is. Yeah, yeah. Yes, it is his silence. I just.
Well, I don't know. It's almost like
I don't know if it's the same word or not. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is spend. Please. Yeah.
It was referring to what? The Shiva period? Or
no, the priests are not allowed to drink wine or strong drink when they're going to go do sacrifices.
Oh.
That's why I made a little joke, no sacrificing while intoxicated. That's the idea. All right, let's spend a little time with Esh Zara as a phrase. What is an alien fire? On page 4, we're going to read this is JPS. The Baruch Levine is the author of the commentary for this book. It's, again, a modern commentary, so it might mention rabbinic commentaries, but it's got a more... It's not interested necessarily in proving Judaism, or that which most rabbinic commentaries are in some way. It's only interested in trying to understand the text. So I'll read this one, because I think the print's not great. Hebrew Esh Zara, alien fire, refers to the incense itself. It could be translated an alien incense offering by fire. The sense of Hebrew Zara, alien, is elusive, and the strangeness implied has been variously interpreted. The text does not specify the offense committed by the two young priests. It merely states that they brought an offering that had not been officially ordained. Okay, so here is the sort of facts on the ground. The first, it's important, Esh is not just fire. We talked about this once before. Again, I think of fire, but they didn't have matches back then. So there was always a fire kept burning somewhere in some way, shape, or form. So it was probably some kind of coal. And in this case, the Esh they're saying to is another word for an incense offering. That's why in the old JPS translation, it said censer. So literally, it's like the thing that Catholics use that like, does a little smoke thing that they walk, it's called a censer, and like, does that. So that's something along those lines. They're approaching the altar. Actually, there's a debate of whether or not it's the altar, but it's probably the altar, with this thing smoking and smelling of this incense as an offering. Yes?
Isn't Ketoret
Yeah, I think so.
So it says, and they put the fire, and then put on top of the fire the Torah, the incense. So fire is fire, the Torah is the incense.
Mm-hmm. Ah, you're right. I don't know why it says that. It's funny. Okay, but you're either way, it's still they do it together and make the incense offering. I don't know why, I don't know what I'm missing there, because if it's that clear, I don't know what I'm missing in this, because he's usually good. So I'm not sure. But regardless, that's the fact. And then we've also got, there's been no time when God said, this is an offering you should bring. So we're not entirely sure. And what's more, Aaron is really in charge of the offering, so what are Nadav and Abihu doing at all that without him? Okay. Yes. Right. I mean, yes, it's the Catholic doesn't exist yet for another 1,000, you know, actually Catholic doesn't exist for like 1,500 years. I was just saying that's probably where the Catholics got it from. Yeah, yeah. There was no, like, that's just an image we've probably seen. We got plenty from them too. It's okay. We've been sharing. I want to now spend a little time on why. There's a good one I wanted to start with. Oh, that was for that one. Why are they doing this crazy thing? And let's start with the middle of, oh, I don't have a page number on this one. It must have got cut off. The middle of page 6. So this is from the Talmud, from Masechet Sanhedrin. Is that someone else feel up to reading?
Sure.
Yeah. Unto Moses.
To Moses he said, come up unto the Lord, thou and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu. Exodus 24:1. The verse intimates that Moses and Aaron walked first, followed by Nadab and Abihu, then by all of Israel. Treading, so to speak, on the heels of Moses and Aaron, Nadab said to Abihu, when will these two old men die, so that you and I may leave this generation? The Holy One said to them, boast not thyself of tomorrow. Shall see who will bury whom. As Rav Papa, quoting a common proverb, put it, many a young ass has died and had its hide turned into saddlecloths for its dam's back.
So there's like, the message almost seems simple, but there's a lot hidden sort of underneath all of this. Tell me, someone say this back to me in other words. Let's start there. Sorry, it's from the Talmud. It means Babylonian Talmud, Masechet Sanhedrin.
Obviously, they're closer to that time than we are, right?
Yeah. We're still talking 1,000 years. I'm not sure the difference between 1,000 and 2,000 actually matters in this context, but... Excellent.
And so then they do, but they don't succeed. And then the rabbi is saying a lot of young people have arrogance and chutzpah.
Yeah.
And they'll get burned.
Great.
And God is saying, be careful what you wish for.
Right. There's a little bit of that, like, stop because you might get, you know, caught in the process. Excellent. Yes. Great. So there, one more.
It seems to me that it is a warning
Excellent. So there are three things that should sort of get your ears up or red flags up in this one, structurally speaking, like what happens. The first is, anytime anyone uses a proof text from Proverbs or Psalms or any of these books like that, you should start to wonder what's going on, because they're these books of sort of wisdom literature, or the Psalms don't really count as wisdom literature, you can basically make them say whatever you want. They're meant as adages often, and so there's like enough room in them to like play around with a lot. Two, what's the first quote is from Exodus 24, but what we're talking about is in Leviticus much later on, Leviticus chapter 10. So that in and of itself should be another sort of yellow flag. It's not impossible, we do that all the time, but whenever we're going somewhere else, so instead of just looking at the text itself, so therefore we're already stretching. Also inside of that, the verse we're drashing on talks about God says come close and lists a bunch of people. And then we're adding in that that meant in order of walking, and we're adding in that in the order of walking, that meant Nadav and Avihu were annoyed that they were second. So there's like a lot of layers there. And finally, we get a common proverb, which is like every so often, especially in the Talmud, the rabbis like to throw in like a local idiom or saying from the times, which is like fine. I did a similar thing a minute ago when I said, you know, sacrificing while intoxicating. It's like a good way of helping people of your generation understand what's going on. But it also speaks to make her wonder what's going on. Underneath all of that, we get the initial question that just what happens in Nadav and Avihu is really up for debate. It is both dramatic and unclear. So it leaves a lot of room for rabbis and interpreters to find their own sort of path through it, their own lesson, to see what they see in the world, to see that in this story. And second, he's using a lot of different sources which really could be used in a lot of different ways to prove his point. But what's great about it is it also works. Like it feels true. And it feels like the kind of thing that maybe two young people who have a really minor role in the Bible until they get killed, but are in the, it's like two vice presidents. You know, what's the saying? There's like a joke about a vice president being, I forget what it is. It's gonna annoy me. All right, maybe it'll come. There's a joke about, it basically says the least useful job in the country is the vice president or something like that. Because you don't necessarily, like, Truman had no idea what was going on when he showed up, kept in any meetings, like things like that, that's another conversation. Regardless, we're gonna get now a bunch of opportunities to try and figure out why or what happened with lots of room for interpretation. So I want to jump now to, actually, we'll go right below. This is from the Torah, A Woman's Commentary. I think it's big enough to read. Someone else feel up to reading? Sure. Either. Great. In the tragic story that follows, right there.
In the tragic story that follows, Nadav and Avihu, Aaron's two oldest sons, offer a ritual fire that God did not command. As a result, fire comes from God and kills them. Like good tragedy everywhere, the story is intended to elicit pity and fear. Pity for Nadav, Abihu, their father, mother, and siblings, and fear that God's terrifying power may burst forth again. The world is perceived as a dangerous place, and God can protect, but also create harm. The ancient world's protection is the sacrificial ritual correctly performed according to prescribed rules. However, contact with the holy must be rigorously safeguarded from illegitimate incursion. If the procedures are performed incorrectly, the sanctuary becomes defiled with disastrous consequences. This story, however, leaves the reader uncertain as to what precisely constitutes the son's transgression.
Okay. So this points to a whole other level that we've been trying so far to figure out what was going on with Nadav and Avihu. Like, who are these people? Why did they get killed? What was going on? If you pull back and think of the Torah not as a series of stories of individuals, but as the founding of the Jewish people, then this is not a story at all about that. This is a story about the founding of the priesthood. That, in fact, you must have this story. It's the first lesson. I had a bunch of friends when I was getting my master's in education that we would talk about discipline, and they would say the most important thing to do is send someone to the principal's office in the first week. It doesn't matter. Find something they did wrong. Send someone to the principal's office in the first week. Or there's another one that says, don't smile till Hanukkah. they're adages. The idea being that you can always be nice later on, but you have to be stern first, and that sets the tone and the standard of that you are the one in charge and stuff like that. And in that way, that is one way to read the story, is have nothing to do with Nadav and Avihu as individuals, but God needed to send someone to the principal's office. God didn't. This is the end, right before that, we just finished everything. Since the middle of Exodus, we've been building the Mishkan. We've been hearing about building the Mishkan. We've been building the Mishkan. We've been putting the Mishkan together. We've been making the clothes for the priests. We made the clothes for the priests. We've been anointing the priests. We anointed the priests. We've been setting up the altar. We're ready to go. The altar, we found out what sacrifices need to be made, when they need to be made, how they need to be made, all of the rules until now. Finally, we are ready to go. And in the first thing God has to do is to make clear that I'm not joking around. And so Nadav and Avihu are the examples. Yes.
This brings to my mind that God is showing to the Israelite that if you don't do exactly as I say, I'm going to be angry and you're going to bear the consequences. And this is maybe to teach the Israelite to follow God's rule and to keep the Torah.
Great. Okay. Yes.
I'm going to be devil's advocate here and say that.
You gotta be careful when you advocate for the devil.
Yes. They died because there was an accident.
Okay.
And what they put the wrong fuel in the pan and it exploded in their faces and they died. We know at this point that God doesn't speak to Aaron. God doesn't speak to Moses. But Moses speaks to Aaron saying that it was God's will.
Yeah, and so right afterwards, we didn't read it. God does speak to Aaron, but not about this. Okay. You're 100% correct. And what's more, there's a feel that there's a certain kind of person who comes to a Shiva house. They come and they want to give you all of the reasons why your loved one died. Every Shiva house has one or two of them at least. Well, they needed to be with God, or at this point it's going to learn, and none of them feel true. And the truth is, that's how, when you read rabbinic interpretation of why Nadav and Avihu died, they all have good lessons, but none of them feel true. None of them feel close to the text. So I think it's certainly a reasonable read that it feels like we're not meant, at the very least, we're not meant to know. Whether it's an accident, whether they really did do something wrong, we don't know what happened, and that there's a certain amount of just accepting that is one way of going about it. Yes?
I can't help it when I read this.
Okay.
Isaac was supposed to be sacrificed. Mm. God held the hand of him. It was a throwback to our pagan days when we did have that. But here, he did not hold back his hand.
Interesting.
He said, we are back. If this is what happens, if you don't go forward, we go back to the land of the pagans and we start the job. It's more than me. It's more than violating. Isaac wasn't sacrificed. Why did this kid
sacrifice? Interesting. Interesting. Okay, I mean, that's a fair question. I appreciate it, yeah. So I have a bunch of other why sources, but I think we're at a point to move to a different question. And one of them is one of the ones that really summarizes a lot of the opinions is the study source in the Pew Bulletin. So come Shabbat and you can read more about it. Or you can just find it in the packet I just handed you. What I want to do now, and I'm somewhere between happy and sad because I get to do a big reveal now, but sad that no one noticed it so far. If we go back to page one.
We're not going to be consumed by fire.
You're not going to be consumed by fire. It's okay. Where exactly do they offer this esh zara, this foreign fire? Page one, verse two. V'teitza esh milifnei Adonai v'tochal otam v'yamutu lifnei Adonai. We spent before God, lifnei Adonai, we spent a week talking, one class, talking just about what does it mean to be lifnei Adonai, and most of the time it was a positive place to be. And the simple answer is lifnei Adonai means before the altar, and that's probably in a simple way of what's going on there. But we have a bunch of explanations of what does it mean that they were lifnei Adonai, or that the fire comes from God. I'm not going to really read much of the, some of them are really explicit, like meaning it means that the fire came from this spot of the altar and it consumed them in this way. I'll just tell you, we don't have to read it. Rashi says that the fire comes through their nostrils and just kills their soul. Like it's a, that's what it means to be divine fire. And that's why there are bodies left. So one question is, the cousins have to drag out the bodies. Yeah. So the one question is, if they were consumed by fire, why were their bodies? Shouldn't they have been burned? Or ashes or something like that. And so that's one answer. The other is, they were dragged, it says drag them out by their tunics, and basically reads them, it says, it means drag out their tunics, that there was no more of them left. But they were consumed, but the tunic, it's all... It's fine, but they're all interesting questions because it's good to understand the literal sense of the text, but not for us today. So I want to go to page 8. And first of all, I apologize. I was determined to fit all this on one page, but it's a bit of a geometric game. So we're going to turn the page sideways. and we'll begin... At the so the top says Ibn Ezra. So we talked about Ibn Ezra briefly. He's the first person to write a grammar of the Bible. He conservative Judaism likes to claim him as the first conservative Jew. I mean, everyone likes to claim everyone as the first whatever they are. But he was the guy who really looked closely at the text and was willing to ask a lot of difficult questions that a lot of other people either didn't ask or asked in a way to try and cover them up. So he was willing to ask questions that challenged Judaism, and usually he comes up with good answers, but he was very good at pointing out the sort of fault lines that today we think of as different sources, but he says, well, how do we make them work together?
You're talking about Ezra?
Ibn Ezra, yeah. Ibn means Ben in Arabic, so he was the son of Ezra. You'll notice he's not a rabbi. He also wasn't a Talmud scholar, which was very odd for someone to be such a Jewishly recognized Bible scholar and not a Talmud scholar. He really occupies a very unique space in the sort of history of textual analysis. They died lifnei Adonai, at the instance of the Lord, literally before the Lord. They had thought they were doing something that would be acceptable before him. So the first, I wanted to start here because one way to understand lifnei Adonai is that they thought that it was their job. That's why you'll notice the translation switches from before the Lord to at the instance of the Lord. It's an attempt to try and understand what they were doing. At the before the Lord, they might have thought that this was something they were allowed to do, basically. At the instance of the Lord. Lifnei Adonai also means in the face of God. So rather than being chutzpahdik and doing something, you know, so terrible, they thought it was that they were in the realm, and maybe their fault is that they didn't read the directions carefully, or that they were willing to be too creative and experimental with what they thought. Whatever the case may be, one way to understand lifnei Adonai is that with proper intent. Okay. Now we'll spend some time with some more lifnei Adonai sources. How are we doing? Because I want to spend some time on mourning also. Okay. Okay, page 5. We'll fast forward to back to the JPS. They were the one that first helped us understand Esh Zara a little bit. Through those near to me, I show myself holy. So again, we're trying to figure out Lifnei Adonai. It's not just that's where they brought it, but this is the holy spot. This is the place where all of Israel becomes holy. Lifnei Adonai, and God says, through those near to me, I show myself holy. About Nadav and Avihu. We think God is saying that. Or I think Moses says God says that, but regardless. Give me 1 second, quickly. Right, so God, this is the other big debate we didn't spend any time on. In verse 3, then Moses said to Aaron, this is that the Lord spoke, saying, through them that are nigh to me, I will be sanctified, and before all the people, I will be glorified. So we don't have any record of God saying that. Moses says, God said, the ones closest to me are the ones that are going to make me holy. We don't have any record of God saying that. It's like an unending list of things we can do with that. Maybe Moses heard it separately. Maybe this is God is speaking through Moses right now. Yeah, Moses is certainly a prophet. Or maybe Moses is that guy in the Shiva house trying to give Aaron some context. We don't know. But regardless, we get this idea. And Baruch Levine says, the duly consecrated priests, we're back on page 5, are near to God. Thus we read in Ezekiel, the northern chambers and the southern chambers are the consecrated chambers in which the priests who have access to the Lord shall eat the most holy offerings. Hebrew karov also serves as an official title, designating the courtier who is permitted to approach the king, as in Esther 1:14 or Ezekiel, where governors or provincial rulers are called krovim, members of the official inner circle. The priests enjoy a comparable position in the sanctuary in which God is the king. So the korban is the name of sacrifice. Karov is a family member. Somehow the priests are God's family. They're God's inner circle, his kitchen cabinet, whatever you want to say. They're the ones who can come close. Priests who adhere to the regulations of their office and protect the purity of the sanctuary sanctify God, and in turn the sanctuary is favored by God's presence. When, as happened is in this case, they flout God's will, he exercises his punitive power, compelling all to recognize his authority. So in some ways, I don't want to talk about the details, but the reason why the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church is such a thing is because it's the Catholic Church. It's the priests whose job it is to tend God's house who are the ones violating. And it is through, and literally through them, God is the opposite. Because this has happened, God's status, at least in the Catholic world, has been lessened. Like, that's a challenge that the new pope is supposed to be addressing in different ways that he hopes to try and figure out, to try and re-raise up, to be close to God means to bear an extra responsibility to make God special. The two sides of the coin are expressed quite clearly in other passages of the Torah. We read, you shall faithfully observe my commandments, I am the Lord, you shall not profane my holy name, that I may be sanctified in the midst of the Israelite people. In contrast, we read later on, but the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust me enough to affirm my sanctity in the sight of the Israelite people, therefore you shall not lead this congregation into the land that I have given them. Those are the waters of Meribah, meaning that the Israelites quarreled with the Lord through which he affirmed his sanctity. Either way, God emerges triumphant, for he will not allow his sanctity to be compromised. In other words, since we know now, or at least the world we live in now doesn't have a God who acts so explicitly, we're saying we have to be doubly careful, because if you even step out of toe a little bit, you lessen the sanctity of God. And we know Esh Zara is not actually, the fire of the Lord is not actually going to come to eat out our souls. So we know now, those of us who become learned, who have leadership positions, who have influence over others, just how much we have to be careful and take care of that and sort of cultivate that, and to really know that stepping out of line has a greater consequence than just on yourself. You bear other weight. Okay. We'll do one more Lifnei Adonai, and then I want to spend a little time on Aaron's silence. Through those near to me, I show myself holy. We're on that page with no page number, page 6. Does someone want to read this one? I think it's readable. This is from the, thank you, please. Through me, those near to me, I show myself holy. So, anyone watch the show The West Wing? It's a show about like the presidency, and basically there's a guy who wants a bailout from, like, his company's failing and like he needs help, and he's been a huge contributor to the Bartlett campaign, who's the president's campaign, and the president doesn't want to help him because he was a contributor. But in some way, when you become the most loyal, the most whatever, you also become a liability. That there is some, or that there is some connection there, and that's what this is talking to here. That Nadav and Avihu were exactly the ones that God had the sacrifices. God needs Moses and Aaron. They're like one step up, and they can keep going afterwards. But God needs to show that no matter what, no matter how close to me you are, if you don't follow the rules, you're in trouble and you're going to be whatever. And it has to be Nadav and Avihu. They're the ones who has to go for the message to be, as effective. In this way, it fits together like a story. It feels like a composed story that has just the right people at just the right time with just the right consequences for just the right result. Yeah.
Didn't they usurp? Aaron and Moses were ahead of them. They had to be behind them. They were not nearest to God. And they had to usurp Moses and Aaron, and therefore they weren't the nearest to God in the sense that Moses and Aaron were.
Right. So then the other piece is it plays up the theme. If we think of the priests as God's family, and Nadav and Avihu are the number one sons, they're the primary, and they're, for whatever reason, and we can spend another year and a half debating this, the Bible is unwilling to ever let the first son get what's due him. for whatever the case may be, always and always, the first son has the rights to be the inheritor, and always it is not the first. It's not always the youngest. Joseph is not quite the youngest. Judah is not the youngest, and eventually becomes whatever. But never firstborn wins out, despite law after law in the Bible saying the firstborn must. You can't treat the firstborn. You can't disregard the firstborn status. Although I'll tell you, I was in a class where they were doing ancient archaeology, and they found ancient legal documents, and it seems, at least in some cultures in the ancient Near East, firstborn status was not about who was born first, but was something that you could change. So like you as the father, basically when you write there were wills of some sort, and you could see multiple versions, like you're not the firstborn anymore, now you're the firstborn. to someone else. And it's that's an interesting thought about what might be going on there. But regardless, I hadn't thought it before, but it really plays up if you know the priests are God's family, that God also, even God's firstborn, don't get to rise up. One of them had to really be the firstborn. It's 100% true. I don't know why they get paired together. I don't have a good answer for that one. The closest thing I can think of to an answer is that they are they're always described as a unit in the Bible. It's Nadav and Avihu. The couple of other times they're mentioned, it's Nadav and Avihu. That's the case. And maybe that's part of the problem, because Eliezer really becomes the guy afterwards. Maybe there were two of them and that's an issue. So
Nadav and Avihu were twins?
I didn't say they were twins. Oh. I said that. 1,000 years later, they'll be like, everyone agrees, Nadav and Avihu were twins. Now, maybe there's a drash somewhere. I wouldn't be surprised. I think it's actually not an unreasonable read because they're always smushed together, but I have no understanding that they're twins. So I want to spend a little on Aaron's silence. And we'll start with Rashi. How are we doing? Oh, very little. Maybe we'll just read what Rashi has to say. So I brought on page 7 basically all of Rashi's comments on this section. But what I want is just a couple of words, and Aaron was silent. You see the bold, and Aaron was silent in the middle of the page. So the way Rashi works is he quotes a little bit of the text, and then he talks about it. One of the interesting challenges of reading Rashi, not in this translation, because this guy does a really good job of making it clear, In the Hebrew, sometimes Rashi will quote the Bible text and use it as the beginning of his sentence and keep going. And sometimes there's meant to be a period and he starts a new sentence. And half of your job as a translator is to figure out which. But whatever. And Aaron was silent. He received a reward for his silence. And what was it? That a divine utterance came to him privately, for the prohibition of wine was spoken to him alone. So somehow Aaron, the reason why I bring this, so in a minute later in verse 6 and 7, which I brought on page 2, God speaks to Aaron and says, priests can't drink when they go do their priest thing. Go ahead, yeah?
Could that imply that the Nadav and Avihu were intoxicated?
Yeah, so exactly. Many interpretations read it backwards and say that's why this is the case, that really what was going on is they were drunk, and that was the problem, and that's why the first rule afterwards is that. But the problem with that, of course, is they didn't know the rule when they went to go do that. So there's a lot of going, trying to figure out why that's the case. But the reason I love Rashi's comment here is it underscores, one of your jobs when you're translating Rashi, after you figured out whether his sentence starts with the quote or not, is you have to, like in Akiba, I'm sure they do it also, like kids in school learn the question, Ma kashe le Rashi? What question is Rashi answering? Because always, he is the teacher. He's like asking, one of his students asks a question and he answers it, and that's how it becomes part of the commentary, but he doesn't include the question. And I think the question here is, how could Aaron be silent? And the implication of the fact that Aaron gets a reward for his silence is the implication that he didn't need to be silent. You don't get a reward for doing what you're supposed to do. You get a reward for doing more than you're supposed to do. That no one would have faulted Aaron if he wanted to spend Shiva wailing and bemoaning the loss of his two sons in the profession he forced them into. No one would have, whatever, but he gets the reward of God talking directly to him. He gets closer because for Aaron was able to step out of himself and be the priestly leader that God needed for this moment and this story. It goes again to show that this is not about Nadav and Avihu. I think this is the simplest read, but this is about the creation of the priesthood and the priesthood for the nation. That we need an example of what happens when it goes wrong, and Aaron has to be silent and can't moan them because he has to be the head priest who understands that there are risks with being the head priest. not to use two West Wing episodes in one class, but it is remarkably relevant. At some point, the president, his daughter gets kidnapped, and afterward, they find the daughter, she's safe, they come back, and he's like floundering for a while, and his team comes to him and says, the country needs to know that you're gonna put them over your daughter. The country, you are the president of the United States, the leader of the free world, and they need to know that you can put them over your daughter. Like, you can't be recovering from this terrible thing anymore. They need to know that you put them first. And it's like a terrible thing, and you as the viewer, it's like a great drama to watch. But it's, I think, exactly what's going on here. That for the priesthood to exist, the regular people need to know that you priests are going to put God and the priestly connection above your family connection. Like, that's one of the challenges that you have accepted for all of the privileges that you get and all of the leadership. This is one of the burdens you're going to bear, and that's how we're going to trust you. So I'll wrap up with saying I leave this story with three essential questions. The first is why? What is it that they were doing? Why were they doing this extra thing? Two is, what does it mean to be lifnei Adonai, before God, in this story specifically? What do we do with that closeness to God? And third is Aaron's silence as a form of grieving. Do we laud him? Are we proud of Aaron? Are we sad for Aaron? Are we angry at Aaron because we need what we he could have also modeled what it is to lose a child, and you know how difficult that is. Maybe that's what we wanted to see. I gave you literally 10 pages of answers to these three questions, and I just scratched the surface. So I think in a couple of verses, as always, the Bible asks us some good questions. So.